You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Every so often, public figures are caught making claims about their pasts that turn out not to be true, but they seem to really believe their claims. Should we be surprised? Well, haven't we all learned that something we thought had happened when we were younger was actually a false memory? But how can we tell whether those memories are true or not? Will Salatin, Slate Magazine's national affairs correspondent, has published an 8-part series looking at the science behind memory falsification called The Memory Doctor. I'm pleased to welcome Mr. Salatin to our show, along with that memory doctor, Dr. Elizabeth Loftus of the University of California, Irvine. Hello, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Hi there.
Dr. Loftus, can I call you Elizabeth so that I don't wind up saying doctor and then Will? Is false memory a scientific term?
Well, it's certainly a term that is well known in the psychology literature. You really can't pick up a textbook in cognitive psychology or many other aspects of psychology and not come across the term. And a wonderful book was published by some Cornell psychologists called The Science of False Memory just a few years ago. So I'd say it's a scientific term.
Well, you write that before Dr. Loftus came along, people thought of memory as a recording device, but that she proved that questions and images don't just retrieve memories, but they also alter them. Was she really the first?
Well, I don't know if she was the first. She certainly wasn't the first to come up with a concept, but what she has done is to develop a whole career's worth of studies and data demonstrating how this works and when it works. And in so doing, she has tried to replicate situations like what you would see in court, people testifying to things that they remember, the scene of an accident, for example, and how easy it is through the introduction of suggestive questioning, not even deliberately suggestive questioning, just presuming that you have the right guy in the lineup or that the accident happened this way, to introduce a term that will then affect the way the person remembers the incident, which in turn casts doubt on the testimony that they give in court. So I think she's paved a lot of new ground there.
Well, she's dealing with humans, but didn't one researcher in the field look into whether fruit flies can have false memories?
Oh, lots and lots of researchers are looking at memory in general in animals and in people. But, memory is very different between a fruit fly and a mouse and a person. So you really have to study these things in the context of the species you're talking about.
Elizabeth, how do we develop these false memories? And is this something that everyone experiences?
Well, there are at least a couple of ways of developing a false memory. One is if you are exposed to some sort of external suggestion.
I think we're having problems with that line. We will get back to Dr. Loftus in just a moment. I don't know what's wrong. We try to fix it, but it didn't seem to work. Now, when did you first become interested in Dr. Loftus and her work, Will?
Well, I've been interested in it for a while. I've been watching her studies. The one that really caught my eye was several years ago. She did one about food memories and basically testing whether you could convince somebody that they had gotten sick eating a certain kind of food as a child and whether they would then tell you that they would be less likely to eat that food in the future. And that has since been substantiated, that you can get people to avoid that food, to eat it less. And so what struck me about that is, here is a scientist who has developed a whole career of demonstrating the dangers of false memory in the context of the law, people being accused of crimes or sexual abuse from years ago. And then in the course of learning how to plant false memories, sort of got the idea along the way, well, what if we could do something good with this? What if we could plant memories of a kind that would get you to stop eating fattening food? And so as she began to explore that, she sort of went in a different direction. And what I found most fascinating about her work is the relationship between those two things and how she makes sense of them.
Well, a lot of people, I'm sure, have connected your articles with something that seems to be happening all too often. Politicians seem to be plagued by false memories. The most recent case, the one involving Richard Blumenthal in Connecticut.
Yeah, that is a fascinating case, an absolutely fascinating case. Now, of course, Mr. Blumenthal says that he has only misspoken. He has never misstated the truth, misunderstood the truth, misrepresented it. But if you read the interviews that were done with Christopher Shays and a few other folks who know Mr. Blumenthal, they seem to be suggesting that over time, he wished to identify. He really wanted to be part of the Vietnam experience, and he really does empathize with veterans, people who fought in the war. Unlike him, he was in the Marine Reserve stateside. And the suggestion is that perhaps in the course of trying to empathize with them, he blurred the boundaries. Psychologically, he felt like one of them, and he began to say we when he spoke of people who had fought in Vietnam. And that is a really interesting phenomenon that I think is consistent with memory research, how we tend to blur the past when we wish to see things in a certain way.
Well, Elizabeth, some people would just see this as a lie that he kept on repeating. Is that usually how it starts, somebody lying and then eventually starting to believe the lie?
I'm sorry, I missed the beginning of the story.
We're talking about Richard Blumenthal.
The phone line problems, but is this somebody who is recounting wartime experiences that it's now been shown did not happen?
Yes, Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut claimed that he had been in Vietnam. He had never been to Vietnam. He did serve during the war, but only after he had done everything possible to not have to go to Vietnam.
Okay, well, you know, obviously, if it's absolutely proven that his recountings aren't true, there are just two possibilities. One is out-and-out deliberate lying, and the other is that he's got a false memory. And he could have a false memory in a variety of ways. It could even be that it started as a lie, and it then became his truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do we discover when we have a false memory?
Unless you have some sort of independent corroboration, it's virtually impossible to tell the difference between an experience that's a product of a genuine memory of a real experience or something that arises from some other process, from imagination, dream interpretation, dreaming, or another process.
Well, what do you do in your research? How do you test for false memories?
In my research, well, in some of it, we know what the truth is because we are showing people films of crimes or films of accidents, so we know exactly what was presented to our experimental subjects, and then we can deliberately try to distort somebody's memory, and it's usually not that hard to do. So we know we're dealing with a false memory in many of my experiments.
Well, how do you distort that? How do you give somebody a false memory?
One of the easiest ways is to ask them a leading question that insinuates a piece of misinformation. So if somebody saw a car go through a stop sign, for example, and you ask a question like, did another car pass the red Datsun when it was at the intersection with the yield sign? A little bit later, you can come back to people, and they'll tell you they remember seeing a yield sign instead of a stop sign. So there's an example of how just a single leading question can plant a piece of misinformation.
And your early experiments with unreliable eyewitness testimony led to your first involvement with the criminal justice system. How intertwined has your work on memory alteration been with legal cases?
I'd say fairly intertwined. I mean, I was basically kind of minding my own business, being a scientist, studying witness recollection in a laboratory setting, and I actually volunteered my services for free to work on a criminal case because I wanted to be able to see real witnesses in real life cases. And the particular case that I was working on at that time was one involving a woman who was accused of killing her boyfriend, and the whole issue was whether it was self-defense or whether it was premeditated. And at the end of that case, I ended up writing an article for a popular magazine about the science and about the case, and pretty soon lots and lots of lawyers and others were calling and saying, could you come work on my case?
Including O.J. Simpson, Martha Stewart, Louis Libby, Michael Jackson. Will mentions that you've testified in over 250 trials, usually for the defense.
In the criminal cases, virtually all of the testimony, except one case, was on behalf of the defense. But many of those cases are civil cases where somebody's suing somebody else for money. I'm suing you because I went into therapy and discovered some repressed memories that you raped me for 10 years, and now I want $1 million from you. That kind of a lawsuit.
And we saw a lot of those lawsuits for a while, maybe 10 or 15 years ago. We don't hear much about them anymore because they have been discredited through the kind of work that you've been doing?
I do think, well, they're not over. I mean, yes, there was a spate of them in the 90s where hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people were suing their parents and their former neighbors and other relatives and teachers and everyone, claiming that they had recovered repressed memories. You do see less of it. It's not over. The reason it feels like it's over to most people is because the media isn't covering it like they used to. It was covered so intensively that it really takes it takes some special situation to bring it back into the news. Somebody really famous has to be accused, or somebody really famous has to do the accusing, and it gets back into the news.
Well, you suggest that a turning point in Dr. Loftus's trial work and in the field of memory alteration altogether was the case of George Franklin and his daughter Eileen. George Franklin was a policeman?
Fireman.
A fireman?
Yes.
And what did his daughter accuse him of?
Well, he was accused by his daughter Eileen of killing her best friend when she was 8 years old, 20 years earlier. And Eileen claimed to have a repressed memory that she'd recovered. And so she came forward and they prosecuted George Franklin for murder.
Mm-hmm. And there were other cases where children remembered that their parents, their fathers, or somebody else had engaged in ritual satanic abuse. Sometimes with roasting babies and the such, and yet they were treated as credible witnesses.
Right, because there's a contingent of people out there who insist that children don't lie and wouldn't make up stories like that, and it's absolutely not true.
What about the other side? In one of those cases, I remember a man was accused of doing something outrageous. He confessed to it. And then when all of the other people involved were freed, the police, the DA, didn't want to free him because they don't like to free anybody who's confessed, even if it's to something outrageous.
And I'm not sure which particular confession. There was one famous confession case, Paul Ingram, who did confess to certain crimes that many people believe never happened. And why did that happen? Paul even now believes that it was a coerced confession.
Well, would that be false memory?
Well, the field of false confessions is a little field all onto itself. And there are a few different reasons why people falsely confess to something. One is that some of them develop a false memory. But two is they're put in a terrible situation, and they are seduced into confessing because it looks like the lesser of all evils. So if you'll just confess that you accidentally shook the baby, then we won't prosecute you for murder for deliberately killing the baby. And so you get somebody to confess to accidentally shaking when, in fact, they didn't really do that.
My guests are Dr. Elizabeth Loftus, who is at the University of California, Irvine. She is a distinguished professor of psychology and social behavior and criminology, law and society, and cognitive sciences at the School of Law. She is a subject of Will Salatin's Slate magazine series called The Memory Doctor. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Will Salatin, whose series in Slate magazine, an 8-part series looking at the science behind memory falsification. It's called The Memory Doctor. Also with us is the memory doctor, Dr. Elizabeth Loftus of the University of California, Irvine. Will, you devote a good portion of the series to Dr. Loftus's personal history. Why do you think that's necessary for us to understand her work as an experimental psychologist?
Well, because scientists are people, and there's a reason why they become interested in what they do and why they pursue the projects that they do. To the extent that they have freedom to choose a field of study or a kind of experiment or a cause. And I think if you look at Elizabeth's history, she has not just, she developed a fascination with memory, but also she has an enduring interest in the legal system and in injustice, the notion of innocent people being put away or innocent people being accused of horrible sexual abuse. And so, you know, it's natural to wonder about such a person. What in her past would motivate her to? I mean, we're all interested in those things, and we all care about justice. But she has not just worked on it, but she has risked her career and herself personally. She has, you know, had physical threats. She's been vilified for more than a decade during what was called the memory wars over incest memories, and you know that took a lot of courage and commitment. So I felt it was necessary to go back and understand what had gone on in her past that would make her interested in memory and in justice.
And, Elizabeth, are you comfortable with this narrative of your life being published?
Well, I have to say it was very it was an interesting experience. I mean, sort of seeing my life, I guess, through Will's eyes and efforts and so on, because there were times that I sometimes felt he maybe knew me better than I even know myself, and that's kind of an eerie experience, since I've actually, you know, well, we've emailed and talked, we've only really met once, isn't it, once, Will?
The reason I ask is because, although I don't want to go into details, some of these things are the subject of false memory, aren't they? Sexual abuse, the death of a parent, a fire that destroyed a home. Are they central to understanding your work and why you pursue it?
I'm not sure. I'm not exactly sure, but probably some of the childhood tragedies, which... of course, I don't think they're false memories. We don't have to rely just on my memory. The fire was documented in Life magazine, and of course, my mother's, you know, obituary was published in the Los Angeles Times. So we know those things really happen, and maybe those childhood experiences, you know, perhaps explain, you know, my workaholic tendencies, or at least make a contribution to them. And how you get from that to this passion about justice, I'm still not quite sure. But whatever it is, it maybe possibly made the story more personal, maybe even more interesting, and maybe even made people want to spend the time understanding the science a little better. And I would think that's a great contribution.
Well, one of the cases you write about is the Jane Doe case from 1997. What happened there? You wanted to say something else.
Wanted to say that I think some of what inspires Elizabeth's interest in the malleability of memory is her own appreciation of her own malleable memory. And she has written before about her mother's death. She will never know exactly what her mother drowned, but she will never know exactly what happened. It was in a swimming pool, and she is, I think, Elizabeth Elizabeth has made peace with the idea that there is a mystery there, and sometimes the past can't be known. And she knows that there was an episode where she was told a story about what had happened and her finding her mother in the swimming pool, and then realized that that was not the truth. And so she knows that her own memory can make mistakes, and I think that has made her very wary of everyone else's memory as well.
And don't many of us have false memories of that sort? We were told a story about something we did when we were a kid, and now we remember it as something that is our own memory?
Well, that, yes. I mean, I think we're probably all walking around with little bits of fiction, you know, mixed in with the fact up there. And we're, you know, for the most part, it doesn't really matter very much. It doesn't really matter if I tell you I had chicken last night instead of fish and chips. It's not very important. But when it comes to these court cases, very, very precise little memories can make all the difference in somebody's freedom.
Well, we all see it in our families. My brother writes about our family in some of his work, and I often remember the story differently. But in the end, it doesn't matter, finally, whether his version or my version is the correct version. They are our memories.
Right, and people will act on them, and they have repercussions and ripple effects, whether they're genuine memories or not.
Well, you write that Dr. Loftus's work shattered the legal system's credulity and led to the end of what you call the witch hunts of the recovered memory era. Because so many of these cases turned out to be false memories?
Yeah, I mean, there is... To understand Elizabeth's work, I mean, her central insight was her notion she's an experimental psychologist. And so her approach was not to take a recovered memory and prove that it was false, which that could be done theoretically in court. But to take false memories, memories that you had chosen that you knew were false, and plant them, and then you could show that it is possible for someone to remember something that is false. However, in court, you can either have these memories debunked. In the Eileen Franklin case, Elizabeth could correct me on this, but I think eventually she accused her father of things he couldn't have done, and that tended to undermine the credibility of everything else that she had supposedly remembered. And so that is one way. And then another way is for these accusers to retract their stories. And there is, if you go to the website of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, you'll see many women who have retracted what they thought were memories of abuse that they developed in therapy, and they decided that those were actually planted memories. So that is another way in which that whole wave has been debunked.
My guests are Will Salatin, who's written an 8-part series on false memories for Slate magazine, and Dr. Elizabeth Loftus of the University of California, Irvine, who has been doing her research into false memories. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Slate engaged in its own form of memory falsification last week by altering images of political images. What did you do?
Well, we tampered with photographs is what we did. We selected some incidents, some of which we thought could be made credible, imaginary incidents, or in some cases we altered. For example, Joe Lieberman had an image of him from the Clinton impeachment trial, and Lieberman had actually given a speech before the trial scolding President Clinton for his behavior in the Monica Lewinsky scandal. But we fabricated that Lieberman had actually voted in the impeachment trial to convict the president, which was not true. And we messed with a TV image to do that. Or another one was we took photographs of President Obama shaking a senator's hand, and we substituted Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran. And that was a really expertly done fabrication, and about 50% of our readers, who took about 5,000 people who took that that survey fell for these false memories, and about 50% fell for the Obama one. And that is a complete fabrication. But when they saw the photograph, people would write things like, oh, I remember this picture from the Chicago Tribune, or I remember all the blogs talking about it.
There's a link on our show page to the images if listeners want to test their own political memories. But it sounds to me in some cases we remember what we want to remember when we see those images.
Yeah, although we tested ideology as a predictor of that. Would conservatives be more likely, for example, to remember the Ahmadinejad handshake that never happened? And what we found was they were not any more likely to remember the incident having happened, to think that it was real, but they were more likely to say that they remembered seeing it. And so we thought that was somewhat interesting.
Elizabeth, have you done similar tests?
Yes, actually, one really cool way to get people to have a false memory is to show them doctored photographs. Some scientists had previously taken doctored photographs and put people when they were children into a hot air balloon ride in order to plant a false memory that as a child you went up in a hot air balloon ride. And they succeeded with about half of their subjects in getting people to remember this event that never happened.
Something as memorable as that? I mean, I'd remember if I went up in a hot air balloon.
Well, these people didn't. But after seeing a photograph of themselves in the balloon up in the air, they began to remember this non-existent experience. And inspired by that study, I and my collaborators doctored some political photographs. We took a photograph of the lone student standing in front of tanks at Tiananmen Square and put a crowd around it and ended up showing that doctored photograph to people. These photographs are shown in the Slate series too, and the results of that experiment are briefly discussed there. So there's science behind this, but nobody has yet done it quite as beautifully as Slate did.
Well, what interests me is that we know that photographs can be falsified, and right now there are simple computer programs that allow pretty much any of us to Photoshop a photograph, and yet we still believe in the truth of the image that we see.
Yes, it's very compelling and very hard to resist. No, especially when it's well done.
The last part of the memory doctor looks at how memory falsification might be beneficial to our health. How is that?
Well, in some of my experiments from just a few years ago, we were looking at the consequences of having a false memory. And so we had succeeded in getting people to believe they got sick eating particular foods as children. So getting sick eating, say, strawberry ice cream as a child. And we were able to do that, and people then told us they really didn't want to eat as much strawberry ice cream. So here you see that maybe planting a false memory about getting sick could be a kind of a dieting technique. And if you could get people to avoid foods after they developed a false memory about sickness, maybe you could get them to eat more of a healthy food if you planted a warm, fuzzy memory.
But isn't there something unethical about doing that? Wouldn't people have to agree to have a false memory being planted, and that might undermine the whole process?
Well, you're absolutely right. You can't put out a shingle and say, come here for false memories and we'll, cure your obesity problem, because there is an element of deception here. At some point, I did suggest in an interview I did about these findings that, well, a therapist can't do that because they can't lie to people. There may be some ways around it, and certainly there was nothing to stop a parent from trying something like that on a, overweight or obese teenager, for example. When I made that suggestion, it caused a little uproar, and people tried to scream that I was suggesting that parents lie to their children. And these self-righteous people, I mean, my response to that was, give me a break. What about Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy? People lie to children all the time.
Well, it sounds to me like what I thought was preposterous, the plot of the Jim Carrey movie Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind might actually be a possibility.
Yeah, well, you know, theoretically, that's where this would go. You would actually go in and say, look, I want this memory changed. And I have to say, we have a number of readers who have commented on the series who have said, where can I get this stuff? You know, I would love to get the false memory that would get me to stop eating this, you know, unhealthy food or get rid of this or that thing. So there is probably a market out there if this could be done. And then the question is, could we control this? Would we want to trust anybody to start messing with our memories, since the whole point of it is you won't know that it has happened? If you did know that it had happened, then you'd know that the memory was false and it wouldn't affect you.
At the end of the series, you quote a passage from one of Dr. Loftus's articles. When we have mastered the false memory recipes, we will need to worry about who controls them. What brakes should be imposed on police, lawyers, advertisers? More than ever, we'll need to constantly keep in mind that memory, like liberty, is a fragile thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole gist of Elizabeth's career, she has illuminated the fallibility and the malleability of a particular mental faculty, memory. And it's a broad faculty, but there is a broader problem of the malleability and fallibility of people. And those people are not just the objects or the subjects of these experiments, but the experimenters themselves or the developers of therapies. And we have to be aware of our own fallibility of developing the notion of memory doctoring as an affirmative therapy, and where we will go with that. Because even if we say today that we're working on a kind of a memory that will only help people, these things have a way of spreading, and we need to think about where this is going.
Well, there was a talk in the past about whether brainwashing, the sort of thing that was discussed during the Cold War, was possible. Generally, it was dismissed. I'm beginning to wonder whether we shouldn't reconsider that.
Well, you know, brainwashing, a lot of people sort of got into the idea of chemicals that were going to mess with your mind, or, you know, hypnotism. And I think a lot of what Elizabeth has done is to demonstrate how easy it is to do this the old-fashioned way. You just talk to people. You tell them a story. You ask them to start imagining what it might have been like if their father had molested them. And it's amazing, with just the power of suggestion and imagination and what she calls a recipe, how easy it is the old-fashioned way for you to come to believe something that never actually happened.
Now, Elizabeth, a lot of the people who had false memories in the past discover them under hypnosis. Does hypnosis make this process of planting a false memory even easier?
There's some research that shows yes, absolutely. Especially you take a highly hypnotizable subject, they're even more suggestible. It's even easier to accomplish these kinds of memory modifications. Then somebody comes out of the hypnotic state and knows that they thought about it, discussed it, whatever, under hypnosis, and it gives it an extra aura of credibility. So hypnosis is one of those techniques that, when used in therapy to recover memories, has been severely criticized. Now, that's not to say it might not be useful for helping people lose weight or stop smoking or, you know, minimize stress levels or whatever else you might want to try to do with it. But for recovering memories, I'd say it's one of those dangerous techniques.
I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us, Elizabeth Loftus, distinguished professor at the University of California, Irvine, and Will Salatin, whose eight-part series on the memory doctor, memory falsification, was in Slate. And as I said before, we have a link to one of the false memory tests. You might want to check it out. Just go to our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you both so much.
Okay, thank you. Nice talking with you.